Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. We got a program tonight that I think really fits with our point of origin, Las Vegas. We're talking about the mob, the mafia, La Cosa Nostra. We've been fascinated with and fearful of the specter of organized crime for well over a century, since it was called the Black Hand. When the vow of Omerta really meant something. Mob movies have long been a staple of Hollywood. In fact, the argument could be made the best film ever produced by Hollywood is a mob movie, though critics might argue whether Godfather 1 or Godfather 2 is the better film. A couple of months ago, I asked our Coast listeners if you would all be interested in a show about the mob, one that allowed us to speak with the real deal, men who grew up in that life and somehow survived to tell us about it. Overwhelmingly, the answer came back yes, and one thing about Coast is we listen to our listeners. I am personally jazzed to get into these matters, and in this format of a show, it's a perfect way to cover it, and in part because I've been covering mobsters and organized crime since I was a Cub reporter. By coincidence, I met some of these guys, some of the most notorious gangsters of the modern era here in Las Vegas, right after I moved to town and before I even worked as a reporter. And the fact that I knew some of them before I worked for a TV station as a reporter gave me unusual access to them later. So I was able to speak to them during times when they simply did not speak to journalists. Those were wild times here in Las Vegas. It was the beginning of the end for the mob. The FBI, gaming control, Metro Police really put the heat on them. And they started turning on each other. It was a bloody and tumultuous period for our city and for other cities, which depended on the millions and millions of dollars which were skimmed from Las Vegas casinos, places like Chicago, Kansas City, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and to a lesser degree, St. Louis, Boston, and New York. Money from here went to all those places. The mafia is perhaps the best known secret society in the world. And organized crime, by definition, is a conspiracy. Conspiracies and secret societies have always been topics for consideration on Coast, so I think, as most of you seem to agree, this is a good fit for Coast, though I don't think we've ever had a lineup of guests quite like this one. In the second half of the program tonight, I'm joined by Frank Collada, who's wanted to be a mobster since he was a teenager. He lived a criminal life in Chicago, then he moved to Las Vegas as part of the crew of a guy named Tough Tony Spilotro, the Chicago mob's feared enforcer, sort of an ambassador from Chicago to Las Vegas, king of the streets rackets here, suspected in perhaps two dozen murders, and eventually the victim of a terrible murder himself. Collada survived by becoming a protected witness. He did some time in prison. He testified against his former colleagues, helped pull a lot of them away, and today he lives a relatively normal life. I have known him since the 80s, have interviewed him a few times, and he has a heck of a story to tell. Part of that story is told in the movie Casino, which I saw it airing today on one of the premium channels. Collada was a technical advisor to the movie, but he ended up in the role, on film, in the role of a hitman, and he even recreated for the film a hit that he carried out in real life. Frank Collada joins us in hours 3 and 4, and he is a fascinating man. In hour 2, another survivor of the mob wars, Andrew DiDonato, a career criminal who spent 15 years with New York's Gambino crime family. That's the most powerful mafia family of all, the real-life equivalent of the Corleone crime empire. The family later ruled by John Gotti, same one, the Dapper Don. You name a major crime, and Andrew will admit to doing it. Extortion, loan sharking, drugs, bank robbery, and murder conspiracy. And like Collada, he survived by entering the witness protection program. He's just written a new book about his years in the mafia. Two other guests who promised to be here for the program tonight bailed on us at the last minute today. William Cotolo of the New York Colombo family called late this afternoon to say he couldn't make it, not sure why. And then a bit after that, our streak continued. Henry Hill, whose tumultuous life was featured in the movie Goodfellas, he canceled as well. I mean, it's a big disappointment since both of these guys are interesting men, but I suppose dependability has never been a strong suit in that line of work. The other guest who will help me tie all of this together tonight into common threads is crime writer Denny Griffin, who has co-authored books with both Frank Colotta and Andrew DiDonato, as well as having written other mob-related works himself. He knows the organized crime story of Las Vegas as well as anyone, and he'll join me for all 4 hours to help tell the tale to you. I think it's going to be one heck of a ride. Included in tonight's Naps News section is a link to the organized crime webpage put together by my employer, KLAS-TV. We've archived probably more stories on the Las Vegas mob than anyone, including some reports written by yours truly, some about Frank Colotta. So if you want to get his face sort of imprinted in your heads for when you're going to hear his interview tonight, you can check that out when you can. There's a link to a story I did about him. And then if you look at the larger page, there's a whole bunch of stuff about the history of organized crime in Las Vegas. Also on the list, compiled by webmaster Lex and I, a dire economic prediction by those big brain folks over at MIT. There's a fun look at Hollywood's Martian curse, the latest sneaky stuff pulled off by chemical giant Monsanto, and an item about a brand new spooky spy unit created by the Pentagon. You probably haven't read about it anywhere. So take a look at some of that when you get a time at our Naps News. Time for our first break. And when we return, crime writer Denny Griffin introduces us to the world of organized crime. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Glad you're with us here on Mob Night for this program. Denny Griffin began his career as a Pinkerton man. He was a private investigator for Pinkertons, Inc., working mostly undercover assignments. He finished as the director of investigations with the New York State Department of Health in their lab division. He did a lot of other law enforcement related work. And then in 1996, he sort of shifted gears, wrote a novel called The Morgue, based on actual cases that he investigated. He's written six other thrillers since then and has morphed into an organized crime writer, written a couple of really good books, knows the Las Vegas organized crime scene as well as anyone. Denny, glad to have you here.
George, my pleasure. Thank you.
You know, I think there's a perception that, you know, the mob is dead, that it's nowhere near what it used to be. It's gone. But it, at least in one sense, it's big business, isn't it? I mean, here in Las Vegas, you've got, we still see mob movies are still popular. There's the Mob Museum that's just opened up in downtown Las Vegas. There are mob tours. You organize lectures for these guys, book signings. Give me your assessment of how big the interest, public interest in the mob is right now.
Well, I've been at the museum now, the new Mob Museum, two or three times and talked to other people who've been there. And my experience was, and what I'm hearing, is they're doing a tremendous business. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of interest in organized crime, the history of organized crime. And you mentioned at the top of the show about Godfather 2 and so on. And tonight you mentioned Casino was on. I also noticed Goodfellas was on. And
these movies
are just, you know, they're still popular movies. They still draw big audiences. And I think there's a very strong interest in organized crime and organized crime history.
How did you get hooked specifically on mob stuff? I know you've been around law enforcement for a long time, but why the mob?
Well, I would have to say that probably my father was an avid true crime reader. And he got in, of course, I'm going back several decades, but he got into a lot of the stuff back from the Luciano era and so forth. And he would always talk to me about it and when I was a kid and run some ideas by me and say, boy, it's a good thing you never met this guy and so on. And I got intrigued and I started reading some of those books. And I became, very interested myself in organized crime history, the true crime stuff.
Ever get a twinge of guilt, sort of? I mean, as I mentioned, you know, you give a lot of lectures, you help these guys sell their books, you've co-written the books. Ever get a twinge of guilt about the idea that, you know, you're kind of helping to make a living based on things that some guys did that were not very nice?
Yeah, you know, some of the criticism with these books has been from, fortunately, it's been a great minority, but as you're glamorizing organized crime, you're helping criminals or former criminals to earn money. I'm always very careful to try to not glamorize it. In fact, as I write these books, I'm thinking, you know, it might, you know, the cars and the women and all that kind of stuff is great, but when you look at what you have to go through, you got to be on your guard every second of every day, wondering when your best friend might walk up to you and say, hey, let's go out for a cup of coffee or something, and he falls a step behind you and he puts one behind your ear. I mean, I would not want to live like that, and I try to point that out in the books, that this is the life these guys lead. And to me, it's not glamorous. Retirement options absolutely suck. So my opinion is I don't glamorize in my books the life of crime. And as far as helping these guys make money, you know, if you get a former or reformed mob guy, I mean, they have a right to earn a living. And if they can earn it through, I'd much rather have them earn a living on the speaking circuit or through a book than I would go back to robbing banks or killing people in some cases. So I don't. I've heard the criticism, but, you know, it doesn't really bother me that much. I'm comfortable with what I do.
Give me your assessment of the state of the mob today. You know, I saw there was a report from back in January of this year, the biggest mob bust ever on the East Coast. The New York guys, I think 120 people that were rounded up. It's not like they've gone away.
No, they're still out there. But, you know, from the people I talk with, they tell me it's a different breed of mobster today. If you go back and you look at some of the old, you mentioned it in your opening about Omerta and so forth, you go back to the Mustache Pete days when the mob took care of its own. You know, it was always the story that if you were the crew boss or the capo or the don, your guys got locked up for something, you took care of the family while they were away. They didn't have to worry about anything. You never saw back years ago the amount of people who are flipping today, making deals and so forth. So one guy told me, it was back to the fellow you're going to be talking to in the next hour, that today, with today's mob, the loyalty all goes from the bottom up, not from the top down. And they're getting inferior people willing to take up this life, and that's coming back to show some of the arrests and for some of the things these people are being arrested for, and the number of people who are turning on the mob today.
Back to a moment to what you were talking about just before about the life of the mobster. You know, we got this image because of the Godfather movies, somebody like a Don Corleone at the top of the heap, living in mansions and taking care of a large family and having standards of honor. I don't know that there's any mobster I've ever written about that really lived that way, that it's like, as you said, you got to look over your shoulder constantly. I've talked to a couple of these guys who said, you know what, you know, at the end of their lives, they're saying it might have been easier just to go straight and have a regular job.
Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is, you mentioned that Frank Collada is going to be on later, and Andrew also, Andrew DiDonato. These guys are very sharp guys. I mean, you know, I've often thought about them. Had they applied their talents and their abilities to legitimate enterprises, they probably could have been very successful at it. I mean, these are not stupid men.
Well, they could go onto Wall Street and steal more than they ever dreamed of stealing as a mobster, and still and have no risk of going to jail.
Exactly. That's true.
You know, talk to me about the standards that these guys have. This is also part of the mythology, but, you know, there was a story years ago, and again, back to Don Corleone. Hey, we don't sell drugs. We don't deal with drugs. We engage in harmless vices that the public wants. We do drugs. That's bad. But, of course, we know that the mafia violates that all the time, that a lot of these guys have gone down specifically because they've been involved in drugs. We know that, you know, they don't touch families, but, of course, that's violated in recent times. This recent bust involved child prostitution in New York City. That would be the kind of thing you'd think the mob would never be involved in years ago.
And I think you're right. And now Frank goes back a little bit further in his organized crime history, back to the 50s. Andrew was somewhat more recent, 80s and 90s. But they both tell me, and other people I've met from the life, that years ago you wouldn't have seen some of the stuff I mentioned. That it's not only the number of arrests and guys flipping, but some of the stuff they're getting arrested for. You probably wouldn't have seen that type of activity years ago. they're into more like this child prostitution and human trafficking and all this kind of stuff. That might not have been a big item or a common item back years ago.
I just wonder if there's anything that they wouldn't do. I saw an episode of The Sopranos where he had a garbage company that was dumping toxic waste into the bay. And I just wonder, would they sell weapons to Al-Qaeda? Is there anything that the modern mob wouldn't do to make a buck?
I would like to say that they do have their limits, but, you know, with today's guys out there, some of the stuff I'm hearing and seeing, I don't know that that's true. I think there's an awful big difference between the mob of today and the mob of yesterday.
Tell me this. Now, you have to, in writing these books and working closely with these guys, you get to know them really well. How well do you get to know them? And is there ever a case where you're worried that they've told you something you really shouldn't know?
Yes. In fact, the first book I did was work with Frank Collada on his biography, and it was set up, my meeting with him was set up through a retired FBI agent who was actually the case agent for the Spilotro investigations in Las Vegas.
I know that guy.
Okay, yeah. But for security purposes, everything had to go through him. I couldn't know Frank's new identity. I couldn't know where Frank lived. I couldn't know his phone number. At the time, Frank didn't have email. So trying to write a book when you're several hundred miles away from each other under those conditions, and then I'd have to, if I needed to talk to Frank, I'd have to get a hold of the FBI guy. And he would have to track Frank down. So I might lose a week or 10 days between contacts. And that just wasn't working. And I told Frank when I said, Frank, I said, you know, this, we're never going to have this book done. I said, you just can't do it like this. So Frank, somewhat reluctantly, gave me a phone number to contact him at. And after I got that phone number, I started thinking, I probably would be, if there was any other way around it, just as well satisfied not to have it. You know what I mean? Because, in fact, the FBI guy told me, I said, I've got Frank's phone number now, so I can leave you out of the loop as far as these routine, almost daily contacts I need. And he said, yeah, he said, just hope nothing happens to Frank right after you got this information. He said it, I think, as a joke, but I thought about it. I said, Jesus, I don't want to divulge anything that could compromise these guys in any way. So I didn't like to know, and there were circumstances where I had to learn their new identities and stuff. So all this kind of thing made me somewhat uncomfortable.
I had something similar with Frank the first time I interviewed him after he got out of prison and still in the program. I had to fly to a different city and wait at an outdoor restaurant, wait for him to show up so he could look around and make sure nobody else was around. Do you worry that there's still someone? I mean, he's making public appearances now. He has, book signings. Those are announced in advance. You got to worry about that. Is there someone out there who still wishes him ill that could show up at one of these things?
Well, we had a long talk about that for when we were still writing his manuscript. I asked him, I said, Frank, I said, you know, when we get this done, we got to promote it. We're going to have to get out and be out at events, book signings or lectures or talks, that type of thing. I said, what's your position on that? And he said, yeah, he said, you know, he says, I decided to do this. He said, because I lived long enough, you know, looking over my shoulder, you know, and not being able to do things like normal people who live that kind of life. He said, let me tell you what. He said, most of the people that I was involved in, he said, are either dead or in prison. And he said his biggest fear, or biggest concern, might be a better word, was that somebody who, if you remember the old Western movies, there was always some young up-and-coming gunslinger looking to make a name for himself, and he'd gun down the old fading gunslinger. That was his concern, not necessarily somebody that he had harmed or that somebody would have a personal grudge, but somebody who might be out looking to make a name for himself. That was his biggest concern. And when we did events, the first few we did, at least, we did one, for example, the State Museum, and we worked very closely with them for security to make sure we had adequate personnel, you know, available, that they had some, and we brought some other people with us. So, and I jokingly told Frank that night, I said, you know, I said, Frank, I said, there's no entertainment here tonight but you. So I said, if somebody walks in with a violin case, I'm history. I said, what's for that?
Well, you know, the Chicago outfit, you know, the New York families get all the attention, but the Chicago outfit could very well have been the most powerful, the most dangerous, the most feared mob family. I mean, it was just extraordinary at the zenith of its power. Is there anything left of that? Because, I mean, after the skimming stuff that was based here in Las Vegas, all the old dons went to prison. Well, I'll tell you what, I hear Stevie Ray Vaughan telling us to take a break here now, so we're going to do that. And when we come back, I want you to sort of outline the status of organized crime now. Then we'll get into talking about tough Tony Spilotro. Stay with us, everyone. Our conversation with Denny Griffin about organized crime continues here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about the state of organized crime in America, and specifically in a couple of key cities, including Las Vegas, with Denny Griffin, longtime crime writer. Coming up at the top of the hour, Andrew DiDonato will join us to talk about the New York organized crime scene. And then in hour three, former hitman Frank Collada. Do want to mention a little plug here for Coast Insiders. We're having a chat tomorrow night starting at 8 o'clock Eastern time with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Very interesting lady, always digging into interesting stories. She's going to talk about strange booms that have been heard throughout the country, as well as other Earth Files mysteries. I might have to tune in for that one myself. Taking a break right now. We're coming back with more of Denny Griffin and then continue our conversation with a couple of mob, real-life mob guys. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Denny Griffin, there's a cliche that you and I have both heard 1,000 times. We still hear it a lot, that the town of Las Vegas, city of Las Vegas, is a lot better when the mob ran things. I know it drives lawmen crazy to hear that because they don't like to believe the mob ever ran anything here. But there was a time when the mob was at its zenith. And in a lot of ways, Las Vegas was a better place to live back then. Would you agree?
Yes. And when I wrote one of my books, I talked to a Joe Yablonsky. If you recall, he was a special agent in charge of the FBI here back during some of the Spilotro reign. And I asked him about that. And you're right. He was he kind of scoffed at the idea. And he explained it to me. He said, you know, he said, back then, he says, you had a much smaller town compared to what Vegas is today. So he said, when I hear all these people talking about they never had to lock their doors and that type of thing, and the mob ran everything and kept the criminals in check and so forth, he said, all I can tell you is, he said, you're comparing apples to oranges. He said, and trying to live with organized crime is like trying to live with a cancer. He said, if you just try to coexist with it and hope it'll stay within its limits, he said, you're going to be wrong. He said, when you have a cancer, you have to cut it out or destroy it. He said, and that's the same with organized crime. He said, you can't let them try to live in your city and just try to have some kind of peaceful coexistence with them. He said, it's not going to work. So he was very adamant that that nothing, as you say, especially Las Vegas, was better off when it was under mob control.
Well, the fact is, though, there would be no modern Las Vegas. At least it would have evolved differently without organized crime, because mob-tainted Teamster money built the town. I mean, the mob arranged to get these Teamster loans to build the first string of mega big casinos because banks wouldn't loan them money.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The mob, and that's why I was so glad, actually, to see the mob museum and another mob. There was another thing called the mob experience at the Tropicana, and now it's been replaced by the mob attraction. But I thought it was a mistake, and I didn't see how you could take that history, and it was history, Las Vegas history, and try to pretend it didn't happen, try to ignore it. I think it is what it is. It happened. It's part of history, and it needs to be discussed and admitted, and not try to sweep it under the table and pretend there was never any organized crime connection to Las Vegas. I mean, that just isn't going to cut it. So I'm glad to see that there's some acknowledgement now of the history of Las Vegas and the organized crime money. And you're right. Had they not been able to get these Teamster loans and the money coming in that way, because I guess the legitimate lending institutions at the time didn't know if Vegas, the gambling concept, would succeed, and they didn't want to take a gamble, basically, on it. So, yeah, had it not been for the mob, there probably, or I don't know what Las Vegas would have been, if anything.
You know, there was a sense of decorum. One thing that was better back in those days is the the mob was making so much money on casinos, skimming so much money, millions and millions of dollars going out the back door, that they didn't want to draw a whole lot of attention. So they sort of enforced the idea that if you're a mobster, you're in Las Vegas, you don't mess around, you don't kill people, you don't rob stuff, you're on your good behavior here because we don't want to kill the golden goose.
Exactly, and that's why some guys, Tony Spilotro being among them, fell out of grace, I believe, is because Tony, and I wasn't here at that particular time, and you would be able to know more about this than me, but my understanding is that he was in the news, his name was in the newspapers, or his face was on TV on a regular basis for one thing or another, that he was bringing an awful lot of attention, and in the case of the mob, it was unwanted attention to his presence and his activities.
Well, you're the guest, so I want you to introduce who Tony Spilotro was, what kind of guy he was, and as you mentioned, I mean, he was in the newspaper every day, every single day there was something about him, which, of course, brought a lot of heat to Lefty Rosenthal, who was, the guy on the inside who was allegedly trying to help, helping to organize the skim, keeping that millions of dollars going back to those Midwestern cities. Spilotro was the guy on the outside, but he set up a whole burglary operation, loan sharking, all kinds of things, and brought street crime where it didn't exist before. Talk about that a little bit, what you've learned from Frank Collada and how that worked.
Yeah, Tony Spilotro, and for people who are not familiar with him, in the movie Casino, if you've seen that, the Joe Pesci character was based on Tony Spilotro. And Tony was a tough guy, a made man of the Chicago outfit. He came here basically to kind of keep an eye on the mob's interests, and came to Las Vegas in 1971 and make sure that the skim wasn't interfered with and that type of thing. Well, Tony was an ambitious fella, and in addition to whatever he had going on with the casinos or assisting Lefty Rosenthal to make sure the casino operations were running properly as far as the skim went, he decided to have a crew of burglars, arsonists, some of them killers, in Vegas with him. So he imported Frank Collada from Chicago. They were childhood friends. He got Frank into town, and Frank formed a crew. They were going to watch Tony's back and supply any muscle Tony needed applied, which could include shaking down drug dealers, shaking down illegal bookies, and they had a nice operation. Frank set this crew up. It came to be known as the Hole in the Wall Gang, because what they did when they wanted to break into a business or a residence, at that point in time, not everything was motion alarmed. And if it was just windows and doors alarmed, what they would do is they would cut a hole in the wall of the building to make their entrance. And they were dubbed eventually the Hole in the Wall Gang for their method of entry and egress from the buildings. And they did Tony's bidding. When they weren't working directly for Tony, under orders from Tony, they were free to steal, burglarize, and rob as they saw fit, and they would have to give Tony a percentage of any major scores.
He was seriously feared. I mean, people would whisper his name, you know, out in public places. There were a lot of people with stories about running into him who came out on the short end.
Yeah, he was, I asked Frank about the movie. I said, Frank, I said, Joe Pesci's character, how did he portray Tony? Was Tony as violent as Pesci's character? And Frank said he was capable of being more violent. I'm thinking, man, that's pretty scary if Pesci's portrayal was mild. He said the only thing he saw bad in his role as technical consultant to the movie, he told Marty Scorsese, he said, Tony never swore. He never used the F word to the degree that they use it in the movie. And Scorsese said, well, he said, that's okay. He said, but that's Joe Pesci's idea. He thinks it makes him sound tougher. So apparently that part of it was a Hollywood-type thing. But other than that, he said the real Tony Spilotro was as violent, or if not more so, than the characterization in the movie.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction that he is suspected in as many as two dozen murders, but was never nailed for any of them. There was one scene in the movie in which he puts a guy's head in a vise and popped his eyeball out. That was real. That really happened. And he wasn't nailed for that one either. In the times that I met Spilotro in person, he was always very understated. Like you said, he wasn't way over the top like the Pesci guy, the characterization, and didn't swear. But he had what was known as a death stare that would chill people to the bone.
Yeah, they said his eyes, and again, I never met the man, but they said his eyes, there was, you looked into those eyes and you could see death. And, yeah, very, very scary. And he wasn't that big. I mean, I guess he was, relatively small in stature, but very tough and capable of being very mean. He would do whatever it took to accomplish what he wanted. And I think, too, in the casino movie, in one place, Robert De Niro was doing the narration and showing Tony and his guys are in a fight of some kind, beating somebody up. And he said, Tony... or Nicky Santoro in the movie, he would do whatever it took. If you beat him with your fist, he'd come back with a knife. You beat him with a knife, he comes back with a gun, blah, blah, blah. And I understand that Tony was really like that. He didn't give up easy. You just about had to kill him to get rid of him.
Describe the setup. I mean, this was after Atlantic City opened casinos. The Chicago sort of had control of Las Vegas. This was Chicago territory. So they had these ambassadors out here, Johnny Roselli, Marshall Cafano, and then Tony. What was the job of those guys?
Well, they were supposed to make sure they wanted the smooth flow of money from Las Vegas back to Chicago. And Chicago had allies. For example, they had an affiliation with the Kansas City mob, the Milwaukee mob, and the Cleveland mob. But Chicago was the dominant. They were the dominant organized crime family in Las Vegas. And they were supposed to keep the money flowing freely and to be somewhat ambassadors. I mean, they weren't necessarily, again, they weren't supposed to be out here killing people or anything. They would just basically conduct themselves as businessmen. And if necessary, have a guy like Tony take care of any interlopers, somebody skimming the skim, or that type of thing. You're trying to keep everybody else honest.
Looking back at it, it's pretty blatant when you think about it, that there's Spilotro running a burglary ring in charge of something called the Hole in the Wall Gang, stealing millions and millions of dollars worth of jewelry and other stuff. And at the same time, he opens a jewelry store defense as a fence or a place to move some of this stuff.
Yeah, incredible. In fact, I read that when I was doing some research for one of the books, I read that when the FBI finally raided that Gold Rush jewelry store, about 70% of the stuff they found in there was hot, stolen merchandise. And there was a joke I heard when I first got out here that they would tell people, if you like buying your watch or your ring the first time, you'll love buying it the second time. Just go to the Gold Rush, and you would find it there.
Describe the relationship between Tony Spilotro and Frank Lefty Rosenthal.
Okay, Tony and Lefty initially... Lefty was a little bit older, but they knew each other from Chicago. Lefty, because he was Jewish, could not become a made man, so he was an associate of the organized crime, not a made member. Tony was a made member. But after they got to Vegas, there started their relationship deteriorated, and in the movie you've portrayed the affair between Tony and Rosenthal's wife, or De Niro's wife in the movie. And that took place, and Frank can address this later on, but Tony actually put Frank on notice to be prepared to kill Lefty. Tony told Frank, he says, he called him the Jew, but Frank knew who he was talking about. He said, Frankie, he said, I think I might want to have the Jew killed, and I want you to handle it. He said, I want to have two guys come out and dig a hole in the desert. I'll tell you where that hole is. And when I give you the word, you scarf Rosenthal up off the street, and you take and put him in that hole. And Frank said, well, whatever you want. So after some relatively short period of time went by, Tony rescinded that order and never pulled the trigger on it. But he was prepared to kill or have Rosenthal killed.
Of course, Rosenthal survived a car bombing. It's shown in that movie Casino, and he, the whoever did it screwed up, and there was a metal plate under the driver's seat side of his Cadillac, and he survived. 2 nights later, he invited a couple of reporters over to his house. I was one of them, and he used the media to sort of send a message. I don't know who did it, but it certainly wasn't the Boy Scouts, he said. And he wanted to send a message that he wasn't cooperating with the FBI. Rosenthal claimed the FBI had offered him everything, witness protection, villas, all kinds of stuff that was probably exaggerated, but they certainly wanted him to testify because he could have said a lot. I'm just wondering, have you ever figured out who was responsible for the firebombing?
Okay, I asked, that's one of the things I asked Frank about, and he is convinced it was not, his feeling is it was, might have been the bikers that Rosenthal's wife had become involved with, possibly thinking that if Lefty was dead, maybe she was still on his insurance policy or something. He says if it would have been a mob hit, it would have been successful. He said, anybody sharp, like the Chicago outfit would have used, would have known about that plate in the Cadillac and would not have rigged a bomb in that particular fashion. So Frank's contention is it was not a Chicago outfit hit or a hit attempt, and that it may have been the bikers that Mrs. Rosenthal had become involved with.
Of course, we'll talk with Frank Collada about the threat on his life, but I guess that's a turning point for him and for Spilotro because he was so close to Spilotro, such a key part of the organization that when he flipped, it was the beginning of the end. Talk to me about the reason that he flipped. Do you believe that Spilotro was going to have him killed?
Yes, I do. There are several things had gone wrong in Vegas for the mob. For example, there was the affair that Tony was having with Jerry Rosenthal, and that was a no-no. The mobsters didn't like that kind of stuff. The bosses didn't like to hear that kind of stuff. And when Frank was took some money, some kickback money to Chicago for a payoff, he was asked, and that in fact was in the movie, where the guy he was delivering the money to wanted to know if Tony was having an affair with Mrs. Rosenthal. And Frank said, I lied, and said, no. He said, nothing's going on like that I know of. And Frank said, I knew at that point that I would be dead if they ever found out I lied to him. So when he came back to Vegas, he told Tony that. He said, they wanted to know if you were monkeying around with Mrs. Rosenthal. And Tony got quite concerned. He said, what'd you tell him? He said, I said, no. He says, everything's cool. You know better than that. So they were a little upset about that. The Bertha's burglary that took place on July 4th, 1981, when the hole-in-the-wall gang went into Bertha's to burglarize it, they expected $1 million take. It was a 3 or 4 day long weekend, and they brought in all kinds of tools from out of town, so they couldn't be easily traced. They had acetylene torches, and they were going to go in through the roof. They added a guy to the hole-in-the-wall gang for that particular event named Sal Romano. He was a guy Frank Collada believed was an informant for the Fed. Frank went to Tony and told him that. He said, I don't want to go if this guy's coming. He said, I don't trust him. I think he's working for the government. Tony said, oh, you're just being paranoid. Take him with you. He said, just keep an eye on him. If anything happens, have Larry Newman take him out. So they went ahead with the job. Frank was 100% right. Romano was, in fact, a federal informant, and he was wired. And they walked into an ambush that night with about 30 FBI agents and Metro policemen. And that was a bad thing. That got big headlines, and they were really caught red-handed. I mean, this wasn't the kind of thing they were going to easily beat. And Frank had killed a government witness named Jerry Lissner on Tony's orders, and Tony told Frank that he had gotten permission from Chicago to do the killing. When Frank, after he murdered Lissner on another one of his trips back to Chicago, the boss back there asked him, who's killing all these people? He said, who's giving the permission to kill these people? Who killed this, what happened to this Lissner guy? Who gave the go-ahead on that? So Frank knew right there that Tony had issued the order to kill Lissner without getting approval, without running it through the outfit. So what appeared to have happened was Tony was under some pressure. He was under a lot of stress. He had a lot of cases pending. for court action, and he was in trouble with the outfit, and he decided to make Frank the scapegoat. That, geez, you know, it's not me, it's this Colada. He's running amok out here. I can't control him. Maybe we better take care of him.
And, of course, the feds gave that news to Colada to flip him, and it worked. And we'll get into that discussion of how that led to the total destruction of the mobsters who are here later in this program. Coming up next, we're joined by somebody from the Gambino crime family, Andrew D. Donato, and Denny Griffin will be a part of that conversation as well. Here's a song that sort of fits. You know it as the Sopranos theme song. It's from a group called Alabama 3. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.